Now stay tuned for the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on 97.9 The Wren. The Wake Up Call talks with the people in Charlottesville and Albemarle County who are making a difference. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for being here with us today as we begin 2021. A topic that's important to me is Alzheimer's. So we reached out to our local Alzheimer's Association, the Central and West Virginia chapter, where we have Marie Galindo and Tina Thomas. Marie Galindo is the Senior Executive Director of the Richmond and Central West Virginia chapter. Tina Thomas is the Senior Director of Programs. Good morning, ladies.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks to both of you for being here. So much is discussed about the Alzheimer's disease. Is that the proper phrase for it? Because I think for many things, people say that's not a disease, that's an issue. I want to make sure that we start by framing it with the proper word.
Rick, I think that you bring up a great point. I know in my family, as folks got older, people would say, you know, that they thought that the memory issues was a part of aging, getting older, forgetfulness. But really, truly, Alzheimer's is a disease. What people get confused about is Alzheimer's and dementia. Now, these terms, sometimes they're used interchangeably. But dementia is not a disease. It's a disorder. And sometimes you'll hear it called an umbrella term. This disorder causes people to have difficulties with their mood, language, thinking, judgment, or behavior. But Alzheimer's, it is a disease. It's a disease, a disorder that's happening in the brain. It is irreversible. It's progressive. And it causes a person to have an inability to carry out some of the most simple tasks as the disease progresses. We hear about Alzheimer's the most because Alzheimer's is the most common form of dementia-related disorders. So most importantly, Alzheimer's is a disease. Dementia is a disorder that tells us about the symptoms associated with Alzheimer's disease.
What are some of the other dementia disorders then?
Oh, great question. There are lots of different diseases that can cause these symptoms of dementia. Lewy bodies dementia, you hear about that. That's something that Robin Williams was living with. Frontotemporal dementia, vascular dementia. There's a Parkinson's form of dementia. Huntington's disease dementia, and some people even have mixed dementia. So they have more than one dementia happening at the same time. Most importantly, if a person is at the doctor's office and the doctor says, we think your mother has dementia, the very next thing you would want to say is, what kind of dementia is it? Because all of these different types of dementias that I just mentioned, they all have signature trademarks, which means that they can cause different behaviors and people will respond differently because of the different type of dementia disorder that the person has. Now, I gave you a short list of the most common types of dementia-related disorders, but there are a lot of different diseases and conditions that can cause those disorders to happen.
So if I'm at the doctor and the doctor says that someone in my family has dementia, and you said to ask what kind, it sounds to me like part two is to ask, where can I find another doctor? Because that doctor doesn't know enough about the problem to assort, to associate which one we have. Or do you need to be more of a doctor more in depth in that area to help me out?
Great question. After you say to the doctor, what kind, what you're letting your provider know is, I want to know What can we do to treat this disorder so I can live my best life with it? Most people go to our primary care doctors first. Often the primary care doctor may send you to a neurologist or a psychologist, or they're looking to figure out what is causing these symptoms to happen. So they may send you to a specialist for some additional testing. Now, I know people have heard about the 5-minute test that you can get in your doctor's office, but the testing is much more comprehensive than that. That's a part of it, but they should be doing blood work, a family history, a physical exam, screening for depression, taking a look to see, is this person stressed out? Is there a metabolic disorder? You know, what are all the other things that could possibly be happening that's causing a person to have these symptoms that they're looking at? So quite honestly, if you're at the doctor's office and they think it's dementia, you're absolutely right. Part two would be, where do I go for additional testing and what needs to happen next? So it may be a little bit of time before you get a definitive answer in terms of what is going on, because it should be extensive, comprehensive testing on the other side of the doctor making the statement that it might be dementia.
And Tina, this is Marie. I think the other thing I would add is that with Alzheimer's, it's a slowly progressive disease. So if someone suddenly begins to have memory issues or cognitive issues, it's likely that it is something else other than Alzheimer's, which is another reason to go and see your doctor, because that is something that could be treated, like a vitamin deficiency or some type of a urinary tract infection or something. So I think also realizing it's slowly progressing, which is Alzheimer's, versus something that comes on more rapidly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great point, Marie.
Again, we are talking about Alzheimer's. The folks from the Alzheimer's Association, the Central and West Virginia chapter, Marie Kalindo and Tina Thomas. Let me ask you, the 10 warning signs of Alzheimer's disease. Mm-hmm. Can one of you list those and let me know how many should apply before I need to be concerned?
Oh, right. Okay, Rick, I'll take care of that for you. So these 10 warning signs, one of them alone may not necessarily be an indicator that a person has one of these types of dementias we're talking about. But really, most people who truly are living with one of these dementias, they may exhibit several of these symptoms. Now, the caveat to that is this. If a person has a significant amount of stress or depression, that could also mimic some of these symptoms. So to Marie's point, when you start to notice some of these changes or some of these abnormalities, it's very important that you're having this conversation with your provider early on, because it's not always Alzheimer's or dementia. It could very well be something else. But the things we want to be watching out for are, number one, memory loss that starts to disrupt our daily life, the way we take care of ourselves every day. Your ability to go into the bathroom and comb your hair, take your shower, brush your teeth, to do that every day. It's starting to impact that. Challenges in planning or problem solving. We see people starting to have difficulties with their checkbook, following recipes in this category. Number three, difficulties completing familiar tasks, loading the dishwasher or putting the clothes in the wash machine or turning on the computer. They're starting to show difficulties with how to complete those tasks because there are multiple steps in doing those. Number four, becoming confused with time or place. Their spatial orientation is off. They're disoriented with day and night, not able to reset. These are indicators that something is going on other than normal age-related changes. Troubles with understanding visual images or spatial relationships. This is really important. Often people will start to have minor fender benders. You know, their peripheral vision is being impacted by the disease and the changes in the brain. So they're having car accidents, or they're having unexplained falls, or they're bumping into things. Their spatial orientation is impacted. Number six, new problems with words or speaking or writing. So this person is really struggling with getting out the right word. They know what they want to say, but they just can't find the word, so they usually pull another word. And it's typically the nouns where people are starting to struggle. So they will start to saying, hand me this, give me that, as opposed to being able to say, give me the pen, I want a piece of paper, hand me the soda. They'll start saying something, you'll start to see more of that. Or the handwriting is deteriorated. Number seven, misplacing things and losing the ability to retrace your steps. This is a big one, because 6 out of every 10 persons who are impacted by Alzheimer's will wander. We don't know when they're going to wander until it happens. And what a person will walk out their door to go to the mailbox and not know how to come back, become disoriented and not be able to find their home. They lose their ability to retrace their steps, come back to the house, or find something that they just put down. Now, we all put things down and may think, oh gosh, where did I put my purse? Where did I put the remote control? But we should be able to identify it without having to go on the hunt. If you have to go on the hunt every time, then we might want to be talking to our doctor about that. Number eight, decreased or poor judgment. Here, a person may get caught in a lot of scams, repeat scams. You know, they may get all of us once, but this is repeatedly, you know. Maybe this person starts dating a really sketchy person or giving a lot of money away to even a family member. So the judgment is impaired. Number nine, starting to withdraw from work or social activities. Can a person's interest change? Absolutely. But we're talking about someone who loved to engage socially. They were very involved. They were a social butterfly, and now they're becoming much more of a recluse. And then number 10, this is a big kahuna, changes in mood and or personality. If this person was always so sweet, kind, easygoing, very docile, and now they've turned into a tiger bear, you know, they're very upset, irritated, agitated, grumpy all the time, that is an indicator that something is going on. And for most people who are living with a dementia and they're undiagnosed, they are exhibiting several of these symptoms, not just one.
So again, that's a lot. You listed 10. Mm-hmm. How can you distinguish when that's an appropriate number to be concerned about? You said that mood and personality changes are the big kahuna, but at what point am I going to be worried about, everyone's always mentions their mother or their grandmother, at what point am I going to be concerned about that person in my life? Is it the mood and memory change plus one? If it's not the mood, is it three? I realize this is not something you can say, if five, then the doctor, or if two, then the doctor. I realize there's no set algorithm here. Mm-hmm. But give me some help.
So let's think about number one, memory loss, it's starting to disrupt your daily life. Your ability to go to church, go to choir rehearsal. You're getting lost coming home from church. You're getting lost coming home from the food line. You're paying the wrong bill. You know, food is spoiled in the refrigerator. You're forgetting how to cook a meal. This is significantly impacting how a person lives. You're no longer able to maintain your house. The laundry's piling up. The mail is piling up. When this is happening, there are multiple variables going on at the same time. And it's not a surprise to the person this is happening to. Even though, Rick, the person's going to say, oh, no, there is nothing wrong with my memory. to the person that this is happening to, they're very aware that something is going on. They may not know what it is. So for onlookers, you're going to be noticing these little weird, what I call one-offs. You might see something happen, and then you think, oh, that was odd. And then you may not see nothing happen again for a while. But the longer the person lives with the disorder, the more frequent these mishaps will become, because the disease is progressive. The longer people live with it, the more progressive the disease is. And the longer that they're living with it, the more they're going to have difficulty with some of these 10 warning signs. So what I say to families is start to take note when you start to notice mishaps with bills, hygiene, driving, behavior, conversations, looping, saying the same thing over and over repeatedly, making phone calls repeatedly and saying the same things over and over as though they've never had this conversation before. These are things that you want to start to take note of. And I always say, start to write things down, because when you have your first conversation with the doctor, if your loved one is there, they're going to be doing everything they can to prove that what you are saying is not true. So you want to document those things, what you saw, when you saw it, what the duration was, how it resolved itself, so that you can paint a picture for the provider in terms of what is going on.
We've got to take a break in just a couple minutes. Are some individuals at greater risk than others?
Absolutely. So women are at more risk than men. African Americans are adversely impacted by this disorder, and Latinas are adversely impacted by this disorder. That's why it's so important to open up this conversation, so that Black men and women know that they are disproportionately impacted by this disease, and that Latinas know that they are disproportionately impacted, and that women know that they are disproportionately impacted. Not only are women disproportionately impacted, but women are more likely to be caregivers. So that pulls them into the fold in a totally different way.
You know what? Well, we are talking about Alzheimer's with the Central and West Virginia chapter, Tina Thomas. She's the Senior Director of Programs. We also have Marie Kalindo here. She's the Senior Executive Director of the Central and West Virginia chapter, as well as the Richmond chapter. I want to talk about caregiving, but let's take our first break now so that we can come back and spend an uninterrupted time talking about caregiving in the time of COVID-19 and how family members handle this situation. So Marie and Tina, hang tight. Listeners, you're going to want to come right back. Be with us. Be right back. And thank you for being with us today. Sunday morning wake-up call. New year, 2021. Talking about Alzheimer's with Marie Kalindo and Tina Thomas from the Central and West Virginia chapter of the Alzheimer's Association. Ladies, there was a mention of caregiving. So let's talk about caregiving for folks suffering from the Alzheimer's disease. With or without COVID-19, it seems as though many families try and do caregiving on their own. Am I right about that?
Absolutely, you're right. And in my 30 years of supporting older adults, people over the age of 65, I urge families, this is the one disease that you don't want to take on by yourself for a lot of different reasons. But the primary reason is the length of time that you could potentially be caring for a person who is living with Alzheimer's disease. This disease can last for a long time. You know, 54% of people are caring for this person for more than a year, and about 31% of people are caring for a person living with Alzheimer's for more than 5 years. This has a significantly difficult impact on caregivers, as I talked about before, how it disproportionately impacts women. But not only does it disproportionately impact women, caregivers as a whole, they have to cut back on spending. They have to cut back on travel, vacation, work. Many have had to take out loans to help pay for care. It is a significant burden on the entire family. When a person is diagnosed with Alzheimer's, it doesn't just impact the person with the Alzheimer's disease diagnosis, but it does impact the entire family. So caregiving is a significant undertaking, and there's no training for it. You can go from one day, you know, just being husband and wife, and the very next day, because of an event, a person could have a diagnosis as like Alzheimer's disease.
So now we bring COVID-19 into the issue, which Tina Thomas, Senior Director of Programs for the Central West Virginia Chapter of Alzheimer's Association, you mentioned this before the break. What role, what's the effect that COVID-19 is having on caregiving, whether it's at home or in a facility?
Mm-hmm. Boy, COVID-19 has wreaked havoc for caregivers and persons impacted by dementia, and particularly those that are in long-term care communities. The impact in the long-term community space is because of the isolation that people are experiencing and the loss of life. 37% more people have died from COVID-19 in long-term care communities compared to what we were seeing last year at this same time. There's a significant amount of isolation and separation. And for the person who is living with a cognitive disorder as dementia, they don't really know what's going on. They don't understand how come this person that's very familiar to them, how come they're not coming to see them? How come they're not visiting from day to day? And it's very, very trying and very difficult for the person who's living with the disease. And then for the caregiver, it's also very difficult, the isolation on the person. Some people, when they become caregivers, they push aside so many of the other things that they used to do and used to enjoy, and they've nestled into the role of a caregiver. And they don't do other things they used to do, so they found themselves in a very unfamiliar space. They don't know what to do. There's lots of isolation that is wreaking havoc on the caregivers also, and the caregivers' health and mental health as well. So the pandemic, I think there are going to be many years that we're going to be trying to recover from all the many things that we try to do to keep people safe as a result of the pandemic.
So there is research being done on Alzheimer's, correct?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yep, there is a lot, Rick, a lot of research is going on, a lot more funding from research is happening. As a matter of fact, just this week, the president signed into law a $300 million increase in Alzheimer's and dementia research for fiscal year 2021, bringing the government funding to the National Institutes of Health for Alzheimer's and dementia research to over $3.1 billion a year. And that research funding is going directly into researching the basic science associated with Alzheimer's disease. It's going to look for how do we prevent it, how do we treat it. You know, we know a little bit about what causes it, the amyloid. We hear about the plaques and tangles. But, you know, why do some people have those and some people do not? What's the genetic components? Tina mentioned earlier women and African Americans and individuals in the Latino community are disproportionately impacted by Alzheimer's. Why is that? So research going on associated with gender studies or communities of color as well.
So has the focus on finding a vaccine for COVID-19, has that work slowed anything that the FDA has been doing on drugs for Alzheimer's?
Rick, I can't specifically speak to the FDA. What I can share is that certainly in March and April, when COVID-19 was first, you know, running throughout the United States, and we were all sheltering in place, research facilities and a lot of research studies did have to stop during that time. Clinical studies had to stop. But now that we have the CDC guidance as far as wearing masks and social distancing, then those research studies and those clinical studies have started up again, just incorporating those CDC guidelines and protocols into the studies. So there was a delay, but they are starting back up again.
So there was a list provided to me of numerous drugs in a variety of roles and phases. You've got one that's currently being reviewed by the FDA. Well, what does that mean? How close is it to being released and used? And how helpful or preventative is it?
So the specific drug that you're referring to, Rick, is called aducanumab. It's a Biogen drug. It's being reviewed by the FDA, and the FDA will make their decision between now and early March on whether that drug can be given to the general public. So it's in a phase three. It's finished its phase three trial. The results of the study have gone to the FDA for review, and they are now reviewing that information. If the FDA approves the drug, it'll be the first drug in over 15 years to actually treat the underlying disease. Because there are drugs on the market today, there are five drugs, but they treat the symptoms of Alzheimer's disease, the cognitive issues. There were a couple of drugs recently released that treat insomnia or hallucinations and delusions. But they don't treat the underlying pathology of the disease itself, the progression of the disease. Aducanumab would do that. It would actually treat the disease by eliminating the amyloid in the brain. So we're very excited. We're waiting to hear what the FDA says. And then to your point, there are over 100 other drugs that are at various phases through the FDA study. So phase one is when they're, you know, working on, they have a drug concept and they're working on computer models. It goes, looks promising from a computer model. It's usually tested in mice. If it looks promising in, you know, mice, then it may be tested on a small group of individuals. And then again, with FDA review, if it looks like the results are promising, then it would go into a phase three trial, which is on a broader range and a broader number of individuals to determine whether the drug has efficacy. So lots of drugs in the pipeline. Very excited about the current one that's under review by the FDA.
So when you talk about, I'm going to try to pronounce this, aducanumab as being currently reviewed by the FDA, are we talking about a drug that instead of treating existing issues related to Alzheimer's, such as hallucinations and delusions and insomnia, are you saying that aducanumab has the possibility of, is this preventing
It would not prevent the disease. So you, in order to take the drug, you have to have a diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease, so the amyloid plaques in the brain. But what it would do is, and I'm not a researcher, so I'll caveat, this is a more layman's perspective, but what the drug would do is address the amyloid that's built up in the brain, which would help people retain the cognitive capabilities that they have, so it would slow down the progression of the disease. None of the drugs that are available today are able to slow down the progression of the disease in the brain. This drug would be able to do that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so when we talk about the others, whose names I will now attempt to butcher, Suvorexant, which treats the insomnia and FDA approved in February for use with Alzheimer's, and Nuplazid, which treats the hallucinations and delusions in Alzheimer's with anticipated decision in spring of 2021, those don't stop the cognitive issues, but they help with symptoms.
Exactly. That's exactly right, which are critical for individuals with Alzheimer's disease who have insomnia, right? People need to get their rest. So having a drug that can be given to someone who has Alzheimer's to treat insomnia is a huge step forward. And the same thing with hallucinations and delusions. Not everyone with Alzheimer's disease has these ancillary impacts. But to be able to have a drug that can be used to help treat those is so important, not only for the individual who's living with the disease, but for their caregivers, going back to caregiving, but for their caregivers as well.
Some of the other things, we are talking about Alzheimer's and currently discussing current research. Marie Colindo, she's the Senior Executive Director of the Central West Virginia chapter, as well as the Richmond chapter. We also have Tina Thomas with us. She's the Senior Director of Programs. By the way, folks, you can go online, alz.org, and if you want the local chapter, that's alz.org/CWVA. The Alzheimer's Association, available 24/7 for support, and we'll put the phone number up on the podcast, 800-272-3900. That's 24/7 for support, 800-272-3900. As we talk about current research for Alzheimer's, there's a blood test for Alzheimer's. It's getting to be closer than ever.
There is. This is one of the greatest breakthroughs, at least in the 5.5 years I've been with the association. So think of today when we go to have, let's say, our annual physicals. They'll do a blood draw and they'll test us to see our A1C level, to see whether we're diabetic or pre-diabetic. They'll test our cholesterol to see if we have high cholesterol, which means we could be at risk for heart disease or other heart issues. And that's with a blood draw. Well, imagine if there was a way to do a blood test to determine if the amyloid or the tau protein exists, which means that if you have elevated levels, however that is defined, elevated levels of that could actually be an indication that you are at risk for developing the disease. And so understanding that people are at risk is critical for, even though there's no drug today, right, but we're hoping that the FDA will approve one, to be able to get into clinical studies or to take care of diet and exercise. It would be important for us to know that we're at risk for developing the disease. One of the things research identified a couple of years ago is the disease is actually in our brains, in the brains of an individual, up to 20 years before symptoms occur. So the 10 warning signs that Tina mentioned. The disease could actually be in our brain, impacting our brain cells up to 20 years before we start to exhibit symptoms. So if we had a blood test that identified those risk factors before symptoms occurred, we'd have a much better chance of taking steps to then try to retain our cognitive capabilities as long as possible.
But Marie, so not to be the negative guy here, but if you're going to tell me 20 years in advance and there's nothing to, only if some minor little things to do about it because you can't stop it, aren't you just making me nervous?
Good question. I could be making you nervous, but in making you nervous, remember, research is progressing all the time. So today we do not have it. In 6 months, in a year, there may be something. We also know that with studies going on, that lifestyle interventions, healthy habits, whether it be for your eating healthy, your diet, exercise, your keeping socially active, all of those things in studies indicate helped us protect our cognitive capabilities. And so even though today there might not be a drug that you can take, if you find out you're at risk, there are other steps you can take. There are also clinical studies that you can get into to be a part of testing drugs that may help you as well. And then, quite frankly, it also would help you to, think about planning future planning as well. So agree, I think it's a mix of knowing that you're at risk and then taking steps to retain those cognitive capabilities. And research is going there. So multiple paths of research, Rick, are going along at the same time.
Again, our guests today, Marie Kalindo and Tina Thomas from the Central and West Virginia chapter of the Alzheimer's Association. I want to get into private insurance and how that is working with individuals and families with Alzheimer's disease and current public policy and advocacy efforts, but let's take our next break and come back with those deeper topics. Be right back, folks. And thank you for being here with us today. Glad to be back for another week on the REN 97.9. We are talking about Alzheimer's. Alzheimer's the disease. Also, one of the dementia disorders, something we learned very early in the program. You can find that at cvillepodcast.com if you're not picking up the entire hour or you feel the need to share this with family, because it's a topic that many people need to know about. Marie Kalindo, Tina Thomas with us today. So, ladies, I want to talk about the medical system, private insurance. So, does private insurance work with Alzheimer's as it does with other long-term diseases? Is it treated the same way it is cancer is?
Great question, Rick. Insurance companies are funny beasts, but a universal insurance that a lot of older adults have is Medicare. And one of the things that can be very, very helpful for folks is to have their annual wellness exam. At 65 or so, you can go into the doctor's office and ask for your annual wellness exam, and your annual cognitive screening. And that is a way to be very proactive. Medicare pays for it. They pay your provider extra money to do this extra test. And it really gives them a baseline and helps them to determine what is going on. Now, one of the things you talked to Marie about was, you know, about fear associated with this disorder. A lot of people are very afraid of that word, Alzheimer's and or dementia. But the good thing that information does is it empowers you, and it can help you to prevent a premature event. If you may, you might be a person who is diabetic or who has high cholesterol or high blood pressure. If you have a stroke, it's going to increase your risk for developing Alzheimer's disease or dementia. So we want to do everything we can to control those things that we can control by having conversations with our providers. Now, when talking to families, they will say, Tina, I'm not worried at all. We have great insurance. My father has Medicare. Well, Medicare does not pay for Alzheimer's care. Alzheimer's is considered a custodial event. It's a disease or disorder that is long-term. It doesn't have a cure right now. Medicare pays for things it can cure. So there are only five different ways right now that care can be provided for older adults. One is you can pay for care and or support using your own money. Number two, find long-term care insurance. And if you already have a disease or a disorder, it's probably too late. Applying for Medicare, utilizing some of the Medicare benefits if there is a Medicare qualifying event. Medicaid, that's how the majority of long-term care is being paid for, through Medicaid. And then if you qualify for veterans support, you can receive an aid and attendance program. So there are only a few ways to get this type of care and to get this care paid for. The majority of people who are providing this support, they're providing it in the home setting, and it's coming from unpaid caregivers.
Do the caregivers themselves, the family members, receive anything from an insurance company if they are doing the providing?
If it's a long-term care policy, sometimes there's a rider or there's a provision made for in-home care, and it could be a family member. You could receive a small stipend. If they're on Medicaid, there is a small stipend that a person can receive for providing care, but it's not very much. It's a disease that's very expensive, and to Marie's point, your first line of defense really truly is planning and preparing. If one out of every three persons over the age of 85 dies with an Alzheimer's-related disorder, you know, the risk, the longer we live, is that we may develop this disease. So we want to start talking about it and start making plans and preparations in case one of us in this house, like my husband and I, develop the disorder. We want to start to make plans and preparations for it.
When you talk about long-term insurance, does the insurance last the length of time as the Alzheimer's disease itself?
Rarely. So basically, you know, someone can live, Tina mentioned this, someone can live with Alzheimer's disease anywhere from 8 to 20 years or more. A long-term care policy will only pay based upon the total amount of benefits available in that policy. Most long-term care policies have a, you know, a daily benefit, and then for a certain number of years, so you have a pool of money. Once that pool of money is exhausted, the long-term care insurance policy, once it pays out everything, it ceases to exist, which is one of the big challenges. And the need for financial planning for individuals who, you know, may be at risk of developing the disease. It's a very, very expensive disease given how long individuals live with the disease and the care that they need, which continues to progress as the disease progresses.
Mm-hmm. And Marie, one other thing that not many people think about are those that are impacted by younger onset. If you are, if you develop and are diagnosed with this disorder and you're 50, you don't qualify yet for Medicare. So there's a whole nother slew of issues related to that. You have to qualify for disability. You have to receive Social Security disability for at least 2 years before you can receive Medicare support to help pay for some of your medical care, going to doctors, whether it's looking for treatments or other options as well. So insurance is something very important on the table when you're planning and having conversations with your families. And I have seen those that are younger, it significantly impacts them, especially if the primary breadwinner is the person who is impacted by the disease. Marie, you know many folks who've been impacted younger onset.
Unfortunately, yes. Rick, I don't know if you're aware, although the majority of individuals with Alzheimer's are 65 or older, individuals 60 and younger can also be diagnosed. And we are seeing, I think, with the enhancement of testing for individuals with Alzheimer's, we're seeing people in their 30s, 40s, 50s being diagnosed with the disease.
So, ladies, if I'm in my 50s and I'm married, what do I do in 2021 insurance-wise? I have one step I can take. What do I do?
Well, my recommendation would be you should be talking with an elder law attorney, because an elder law attorney, though it's not an insurance agency, can help you make plans with your finances, and help you to protect some of your resources.
Okay, so Marie and Tina, tell me, as we were talking about insurance and support of the caregivers and signing up for your insurance elder law attorney, what sort of public policy and advocacy efforts are being made towards the government for assistance, if any?
So, Rick, we're doing a lot from a public policy and an advocacy perspective, not only with the Alzheimer's Association and the Alzheimer's Impact Movement, which is a 501c4 organization, a sister organization to the Alzheimer's Association, but our volunteer advocates as well. So in Virginia, during this past General Assembly special session, we had a number of bills pass that were supported and advocated for by the Alzheimer's Association. Briefly, one of them required visitation to be allowed in nursing homes and in hospice. If you'll remember, there was a while when individuals could not visit their families and relatives who were in assisted living facilities or nursing homes. And so a bill was passed that went into effect in October that required visitation be allowed using CDC and CMS guidelines. We also had a bill passed that required data be reported about the impact, the results of testing on the Virginia Department of Health website. So how many people in facilities had tested positive, how many deaths had there been, et cetera. So lots of transparency as far as the numbers. And then the third item was making sure that there were budgeted funds for the Virginia Department of Health to make sure that long-term care facilities had access to tests if supplies were limited. So a lot of work done on the state level with the General Assembly associated with COVID-19. And then from a federal perspective, we're very proud in 2020 that two bills were signed into law. One is the Promoting Alzheimer's Awareness to Prevent Elder Abuse Act. That was just signed into law the last couple of weeks. And what that what that act does is it improves the quality of interactions and training that professionals receive, the professionals who support victims of abuse who are living with Alzheimer's or another form of dementia. So think about training for law enforcement officers, prosecutors, judges, medical personnel, having an awareness and a better understanding of Alzheimer's disease, how it manifests itself for those who may be victims of elder abuse to prevent that abuse. And then earlier this year, we also had the Younger Onset Alzheimer's Disease Act that was signed into law. And what was so important about that specific act is we were speaking earlier about the fact that individuals younger than the age of 65 can develop Alzheimer's disease or another form of dementia. Well, in the past, in order to have access to programs such as Meals on Wheels or transportation, you had to be 60 years of age or older. But again, as a result of our advocates working with our representatives and congressmen, the age on to receive access to those care and support like Meals on Wheels or transportations was lowered to younger than age 60 if the individuals had Alzheimer's or another form of dementia.
You mentioned just recently a financial funds being signed, being made available, correct? How many millions or billions of dollars you said were signed by President Trump?
So when he signed the bill just in the past week to keep the government running, it included a $300 million increase in Alzheimer's and dementia research funding, which puts us to a total of $3.1 billion, with a B, billion dollars a year going to the National Institutes of Health specifically for Alzheimer's and dementia research funding.
Is there any funding, whether from the federal government, whether from the state government, coming down to the Central West Virginia chapter for the Alzheimer's Association, where the two of you work, Marie Colindo and Tina Thomas, our guests today, for your programs and services, or is that strictly all donations?
So we do not receive funding from the government, whether it's for care, our care and support services or anything that we do. We raise 100% of our funds to support our care and support activities and everything we do for the mission of the association. I do want to add, the Alzheimer's Association is the largest nonprofit funder of Alzheimer's disease research. So the association ourselves actually funds researchers, early career investigators, as well as, and that's in addition to the money that's being funded directly by the government to the National Institutes of Health. But to answer your last question, Rick, we raise 100% of our funds. Our largest source of donations is our Walk to End Alzheimer's that we hold in the fall of every year.
So I'm curious. I know that we mentioned earlier that there are certain groups that have greater risks than others. So tell me about, you've got an upcoming forum in Charlottesville for the African-American community. Tell me about that. And then our time is winding down, and so I want to find out, I mentioned the phone number for 24/7 support, which we'll put up on the podcast page, but some of the support groups and activities that are available at the local level.
Yes. On January 18th, we will be hosting a virtual
African American Community Forum. The event is to target Black people in communities, but also those who support Black folks in certain communities. We want to have a conversation with the community to find out how Alzheimer's disease and dementia is impacting them. We want to find out about some of the barriers in the community. And then we want to work with other community partners to better build an infrastructure to support folks within the community, talking with them, making sure they know how to access resources, making sure that they know what is available for them. There's absolutely no cost to attend this event. And it's going to be a great way for us to better support the community, really teaching the community how to support themselves, us working with them, finding out what their needs are, and then trying to connect them with the resources that they need to support one another within the community. Because there are so many people living with Alzheimer's and dementia, far more than what we can do by ourselves. So we really do need the community to come together to help support these folks who are impacted by Alzheimer's disease and dementia.
So I didn't do a very good time of leaving enough time for this. So in the last minute, some of the support groups and early stage activities on the local level.
Perfect. Folks can dial 800-272-3900. And one of my colleagues will be more than happy to let you know about support groups that are going on, educational programs, and you can also go to our website at www.alz.org/CWVA. And there you'll find out information about all of our upcoming programs, and you'll also find out information about our support groups. Support is essential for caregivers because many caregivers are going down. Almost 40% of caregivers are dying before the person who has Alzheimer's. You don't want to go this alone, and you don't have to.
Ladies, thank you so much. Marie Colindo, she's the Senior Executive Director of the Central and West Virginia Chapter, as well as the Richmond Chapter of the Alzheimer's Association. Tina Thomas, Senior Director of Programs. Really appreciate you being here and educating me and our listeners today. Thank you.
Thank you, Rick.
Thank you. Thank you. And Happy New Year.
And to you as well. Next week, join us and be back with us again. And let's get back to the Wren playing our favorite oldies.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on Real Oldies 97.9 The Wren. The Wake Up Call is produced by Dan Gould. Show archives can be found at SeavillePodcast.com. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for The Wake Up Call, only on 97.9 The Wren.